You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with a triumphant Daniel Freib. Eight in your list of 18 riders to watch at Milan San Remo. Eight of your 18 finished in the top 18. Happy with that?
He didn't even have the winner in the 18.
The winner was a bit of a proxy for Mads Pedersen, because we thought we were under the mistaken impression that Mads Pedersen was going to lead the team, at least in the first part of the podcast last week.
And you then must we have learned, been really shocked when you saw that he was up there in racing in Belgium the day before Milan San Remo.
Well, actually,
I
spoke to someone from the team, and they were also surprised that he wasn't doing Milan San Remo, and that he has never done Milan San Remo, in fact. So I'm going to claim 9 of the 18, but a good return, I'm not sure. I'm not thrilled with that performance. Also, I criminally omitted the criminally underrated Anthony Turgis, who was 10th.
Yeah, yeah. And Lionel Burney is there as well. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard. Hello.
No, I mean, not bad. To be fair, Daniel, you called it correctly in terms of how the race would be won. You absolutely nailed that. You just got the wrong rider.
Well, again, I don't want to pour cold water on Daniel's predictions here, wobbling his head as I speak. But, I mean, Milan San Remo basically has three set menus, doesn't it? And what we saw on Saturday was set menu B.
Oh, yeah.
Late attack coming off the Poggio.
I mean, of course, you pointed this out, Lionel, last week, of course, you know.
You make it sound so easy, Lionel. Yeah.
Well, I thought it was so obvious that it didn't need saying.
Riders just have to select from the menu.
That's not what I mean. You're misrepresenting me already.
Garçon, I'll have an attack near the top of the Poggio.
In Lionel's case, it's usually the menu gourmande, the 69 euro menu.
That's an attack up the Poggio on the descent and then clipping away in the last couple of kilometres as well. When you said Pedersen, though, Daniel, I thought you meant Casper Pedersen, but he didn't finish in the top 18 either. So anyway, we're going to spend most of this week's episode talking about Milan San Remo and how the race was won by Jasper Stuyven and how it wasn't won by the Galacticos, who we spent a lot of last week's episode talking about. There were three very strong favourites for the race. None of them won. So what happened? Well, we'll talk about that in this week's episode. But first of all, Lionel, do you have a news roundup, please?
I do indeed, Richard. Yeah, Jasper Stuyven's victory for Trek Segafredo was part of an Italian double and then treble for Trek Segafredo, because the following day, Elisa Longo Borghini won the Women's World Tour race, the Trofeo Alfredo Binda. And then Matteo Moschetti won the Per Sempre Alfredo race, a 1.1 race. So Trek Segafredo had a fine old time in Italy over the weekend. And as you say, Rich, we'll talk all about the edition of Milan San Remo in this podcast. There was also some racing in Belgium before the weekend as things head towards the classics and, well, the run towards the Tour of Flanders in a couple of weeks' time. There was a Nokere Corsa, which was won by Ludovic Robit of the Bingo Wallonie Bruxelles team. And then on Friday, there was the Bredina Classic, which was taken by Tim Merlier of Alpecin Phoenix, continuing his run of excellent form. He's now had 3 wins in as many weeks. And much to Daniel's surprise, Mads Pedersen of Trek Segafredo was second in that race. Just a light aperitif before Milan San Remo that he didn't ride on Saturday. Big story developed and put into the public domain by Patrick Lefevre. I've got a slightly cynical take on this story, but his column in Het Nieuwsblad claims that the boss of the Bora company wants to buy lock, stock and barrel the De Koninck Quickstep team in order to get their hands on Remco Evenepoel. Now, my slight cynical take on this is that whenever Lefevre is in search of a sponsor, he comes up with an eye-catching story like this, doesn't he, to get his team and business into the headlines. And obviously he's got the perfect vehicle to do this with his column in one of Belgium's biggest newspapers.
Well, Lionel, The way it was written, it did sort of suggest that Denk was attempting, I don't know whether it was a friendly take.
This is Ralph Denk, who's the general manager of the Bora Hansgrohe team, we should say.
Yes, I don't know whether he was sort of, it was a hostile takeover offer or a sort of friendly platonic takeover offer. But I suppose what we should bear in mind is that Patrick Lefebvre, the De Koninck Quickstep manager, I think he has four riders under contract beyond the end of this year. I think that's Remco Evenepoel, Mauri van Sevenen, who's one of the up-and-coming stars of that team, Julien Alaphilippe, and I think the other one is, it is Davide Ballerini. So really, Denk was making an offer for those four riders because, as we know, bike teams, professional bike teams, don't really have that much in the way of fixed assets. So I think maybe something has been sort of lost in translation there. But from what I can understand, Patrick Lefebvre was not thrilled, not so much about the offer, but the way it was kind of phrased and put to him, and Denk sort of asked Lefebvre or what role he saw himself having if they could strike some kind of deal, some sort of merger of the two entities, you know, as though Lefebvre was going to, I don't know, become some sort of T-boy or office dog's body. And I think that's what has upset Patrick Lefebvre more than the fact that another team is interested in those four riders who he has under contract next year.
Interesting. There's been reports today that Paris-Roubaix may be in doubt. Remember, it was cancelled twice last year, first in the spring and then in the autumn. And, well, the situation with COVID-19 is worsening in northern France. Richard, you're actually in northern France. What's the picture like over there, and how are these reports shaping up at the moment?
Yeah, it's my local race, Paris-Roubaix. It's not great. The new restrictions as of Friday evening, so just changes to the restrictions that are already in place. A lot more shops have closed. You're only allowed to travel within 10 kilometres of your house now. Curfew is extended from 6 to 7 p.m., however. And I think the issue here is really around Paris and around Lille in particular and Calais, intensive care is full to capacity, and that's the big problem. France's vaccination rollout hasn't been very fast, but apparently 11% of the population have been vaccinated, and particularly in the older age categories. So the death rate is falling in the older age categories, but younger people in intensive care now. And so I think while some sports are going on, and Paris-Nice went on, politically, locally, I think Paris-Roubaix might be in jeopardy. And the local politician who was interviewed on French television or French radio this morning expressed some surprise that races were still going on in Belgium, where the situation is quite similar. So, it doesn't look great for Paris-Roubaix. You would hope it will be postponed rather than cancelled, as happened last year. And then, of course, it was cancelled a second time, or cancelled when it was supposed to be held in October. So fingers crossed, if it is postponed, it can be rescheduled for later in the year, not least because it would be the first women's edition of Paris-Roubaix this year. So it's a kind of eagerly anticipated date on the calendar. But whether it moves from April, I guess we'll find out very soon, because that's very close.
Chaps, live corrections corner, if I may. I think I said Davide Ballerini was under contract with De Koninck Quickstep next year. The fourth rider is actually not Ballerini, it's Yves Lampaert, who I think has a contract with De Koninck Quickstep next year. But there has also been talk of Ralph Denk and Bora Hansgrohe making an offer for Davide Ballerini. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with that team, regardless of the Lefebvre question, what happens with Bora Hansgrohe, because Peter Sagan, of course, is out of contract as well at the end of the year.
One other story that we've touched on a few times, particularly, Daniel, when you were mentioning the interview that Thibaut Pinot had given, in which he mentioned that he'd not had any out-of-competition testing in the past year, or not as much as he might have expected. I decided to contact the UCI, who then put me in touch with the relatively new international testing agency, which oversees all of the dope testing in cycling. And
in most Olympic sports now.
That's right. Yeah, they're based just around the corner in Switzerland, in Lausanne, in Switzerland.
I thought you were going to say in what?
No, round the corner from the UCI. I mean. But they are they are independent of the individual governing bodies, aren't they? And, well, the figures that I got back were that in 2019, there had been a total of 14,333 samples collected, both in and out of competition. And in 2020, there were around 9,500 samples collected, 70% of which were collected out of competition. And the ITA is saying that the reduction in overall number of tests is due to the number of events that were cancelled. And they say that overall, there was only a 15% reduction in out-of-competition testing in cycling compared to the previous year. So perhaps not as patchy a picture as we might have imagined. I don't know what you think about that, Daniel.
Well, I was just going to add, Lionel, I was listening the other day to a podcast, I think it's called the Anti-Doping Podcast, which is interesting and highly recommended. But on one of the episodes, recent episodes, there was a gentleman from, he might be the director of the Danish Anti-Doping Agency, and he talked about some of the innovative solutions that certain anti-doping agencies, national anti-doping agencies, have had to adopt in the coronavirus lockdown, i.e. A system whereby the tester sort of knocks on a rider or an athlete's door and kind of puts a test kit through the letterbox. And obviously this doesn't meet the standards, the usual standards for, you know, checking a sample isn't being tampered with and so forth and so on. But some anti-doping agencies have decided or did decide that this was the best compromise in the circumstances. So I don't know what that would have meant had someone tested positive. Presumably it would have been quite a thorny issue legally.
I think this is something we'll return to, the whole move of testing and responsibility for anti-doping, moving from the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation to the ITA is not uncontroversial, and there's some suspicion that it's got more to do with the politics of the IOC than the fight against doping. That's an allegation that's been levelled at David Lapartion, the president of the UCI. This transition has only just taken place, and there's some scepticism about whether the ITA will be as well placed as the CADF to really investigate cycling specific allegations and goings on there. So we'll keep an eye on that and maybe cover it in more detail in a later episode.
Meanwhile, the former British Cycling and Team Sky doctor, Richard Freeman, has been permanently struck off the medical register in Britain. That's basically the ultimate sanction for a medical practitioner, isn't it, to lose their licence to work as a doctor. That's because he was found guilty by the Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service. Well, he'd already admitted, I think, 18 of the 22 charges against him, and then was found guilty of most of the others. I think in all, he'd either admitted or found guilty of 21 of the 22 charges. And the bombshell conclusion of the tribunal was that he had ordered testosterone, knowing or believing it would be used by a rider. So Dr. Freeman's lawyer says that an appeal is likely, highly likely, Dr. Freeman has paid a very high price there. He's lost his livelihood, effectively, hasn't he? So, again, I think that's a story that will continue to run. Back to the racing. This week, we're going to talk about Milan-San Remo, but there's a lot of racing over the course of this week and the weekend. The Volta Ciclista a Catalunya has got underway, and that runs until the weekend, and then it's all eyes on the cobbles as well, with the three races in Belgium. First of all, the OxyClean Classic, as the Brugge de Panne one-day race is now known. That's on Wednesday for men and Thursday for women. The E3 Saxo Bank Classic on Friday, and then Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. So we can, well, pretty confident that the Tour of Flanders will go ahead as it stands, but we are heading towards the Cobble Classics. Just a plug for the Lionel of Flanders series, which will be released episodically from Wednesday this week. Wednesday to Sunday. That's the series I made 4 years ago when I went over to Belgium to discover these races. The order of the races has been jiggled about a little bit, hasn't it? Because I saw Dwars Door of Vlaanderen, which is now moved on the calendar. But if you want to immerse yourself in Flandrian cycling culture, that five-part series will be available for friends of the podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, where you can also see all of the episodes that are available for friends and sign up in a few easy steps as well.
You're listening to The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iwaka.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWaka. Very grateful indeed to them for their support over the past year and a quarter, really. And in fact, this is our penultimate episode in association with iWaka. Next week is our last one, but they've been fantastic title sponsors for us through a very difficult period for everyone. Especially business, and iWaka's business is supporting small businesses. So it's been a tough period for them, but they have not wavered in their support of the cycling podcast. And they've been fantastic partners for us, and very enthusiastic about the relationship that we've forged over the last year and a bit. And we're sorry to see them go, but very grateful indeed to them for their support over the last year. I'm sure you chaps would both echo that. On with Milan-San Remo then. A typical Milan-San Remo in lots of ways, in that not a lot happened for many hours, and then there was an absolutely thrilling finale. Would that finale be so thrilling without the hours of tedium before it? Is that, you know, it's all part of the package, really. So many talking points, the Galacticos and how they got on, Jasper Stuyven and his incredibly well taken win. But Lionel, you watched every second, every metre of action. How was it?
I did, Richard. Yeah, I felt one of us ought to watch it all. And I watched all 6 hours, 38 minutes and 6 seconds of action, including the neutralised section, the 7.5 kilometre rollout from Milan. And, well, as I said before, I wasn't being dismissive of the race, but it was Milan-San Remo. Set menu B, wasn't it? I mean, a lot is made of how exciting the fight to get into the break often is, and certainly during the Grand Tours and some of the other classics, we see a real humdinger. And there have been many days over the years when, you know, a break in a stage of the Tour or the Giro might take an hour to go clear, and there's, you know, toing and froing and really frantic racing. Rarely the case in Milan-San Remo, because it's 300 kilometres long, and they're not going to spend an hour fighting to get into what is almost certainly going to be a doomed break. So the break just sort of slipped away, really, and then one or two got across to it, and then that was it. And then the gap went up, and then Tim de Klerk and a few others kept that gap very, very manageable. I mean, it really wasn't allowed off the leash at all. So it wasn't like there was a sort of, you know, an unforeseen dramatic possibility of anything remarkable happening until they got to the three Capi climbs, which is really the beginning of the end of the race, isn't it? And that's where it kind of stuff started to happen. Sam Bennett was off the back because he needed a bike change, and then he had quite a tough fight to just get back into touch with the peloton. The pace on the Cipressa, really very high. Jumbo Visma were in control at that point, weren't they? Sam Omen was on the front for a lot of the way up the Cipressa, but no attacks to speak of, just a few of the sprinters. Gaviria and Christoph got dropped there. And surprising to me was Alberto Bettiol got dropped on the Cipressa as well. I was perhaps expecting a bit more from him. And then it came down to the Poggio. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Milan-San Remo often or always comes down to the Poggio and the run-in. And it was 15 minutes of high-octane excitement. But I probably didn't need to watch the 6 hour, 20-odd minutes that preceded that, to be perfectly honest. But I enjoyed the scenery, you know?
Wine glass rating, Daniel, how did the race rank for you?
Well, I think it was a classic Milan-San Remo, underlined all the reasons why people think it's, or can think it's, boring, mistakenly, in my opinion, and all the reasons why there are others among us who are consistently exhilarated by it. I think you know, the finale, I think in the past we've used as the analogy of sort of a game of Tetris in the latter stages, where the blocks are just moving so fast that there is no scope to make any kind of corrective action. You know, once riders have committed, they have to really pursue, you know, whatever strategy they've decided to take. And, you know, hesitation is always, always punished. And you really, you know, other races you can examine and pore over with almost with a telescope in the case of Grand Tours. There are other races that you can analyse with a microscope. With Milan-San Remo, it's a nanoscope. To understand exactly what happened to the sort of top 20 riders, or, you know, take the 18 that I tipped, you have to go back and watch the race from really the Cipressa 18 different times, and you have to pick out that rider, because every micro movement you feel as though it counts. And I mean, we'll come on later to talk about, you know, what happened, what befell in the likes of Mathieu van der Poel and the other Galacticos. But, you know, the origins of their sort of demise or you know, lack of success are to be found in that kind of minute forensic analysis, I think. And it in most cases came down to positioning.
Well, the case of van der Poel, I mentioned in last week's episode his issues with positioning, which had been evident at Tirreno Adriatico. He's got, and I've said as well, and we heard from a few riders last week saying that his team can be underestimated. You know, they won it on Friday in Belgium. They have a team of good riders, but whether they have a good team is still another question, I think, when it comes to looking at the sort of support that van der Poel is given. He's often left with quite a lot to do himself. And I'm not sure whether, I suspect that is partly because that's how he likes to operate. You know, I was contrasting him, his run into the Poggio in particular, with Wout van Aert, who had terrific team support and seems very comfortable to be, you know, sitting behind teammates. I'm not sure, so sure van der Poel is the same, has the same sensibility almost. He kind of likes to do his own thing, but it did mean that he was left with a lot to do on the run into the Poggio and then on the Poggio itself before he made a big effort to bridge across to Alaphilippe and Van Aert when they got very briefly clear. He did look a bit sluggish maybe compared to Tirreno Adriatico, so it may be taken a bit out of him, as some people suspected it might. But he did make life quite hard for himself. And as you say, Daniel, you can't really afford to do that at Milan-San Remo.
I mean, my take, having ridden 0 years as a professional, zero races, zero Milan-San Remos, was that it wasn't so much his team. I thought he was sloppy. I thought, you know, after the Cappi, he was a little bit sloppy. You know, he was in a good position, then he let himself just, you know, just sort of carelessly drift back in the peloton. Then he, you know, you can say, well, there was no damage done because he was where he needed to be at the top of the Cipressa, but what it took to get back up there might have been quite significant. And then at the bottom of the Poggio, a kilometre before the foot of the Poggio, he was in sixth or seventh wheel. And then by the time Ganna led the race onto the Poggio, he was back in 20th, 30th, 40th wheel. And, you know, I mean, it was sort of reminding me of a, you know, 1980s yuppie on Wall Street with his big mobile phone and sort of Gordon Gekko braces on, you know, bowling into a casino on payday. Van der Poel, so much talent, so many watts to spare, but just sort of frittering at the blackjack table and on the poker, you know, at the roulette wheel, and then not having enough money to get a taxi to get the bus home, you know. I mean, because I just thought that, I mean, especially when you looked at his comments after the race, he sort of maligned the fact that he you know, that he was too far back at the key moment on the Poggio. Well, you know, the attack on the Poggio, the move on the Poggio always goes at exactly the same point, always. And if you're in 20th or 30th wheel, you're 200 meters from the front of the race. On the Poggio, or 150 meters, and that's you know, I don't know what speed they were going. It must be upwards of 30, 35 kilometers an hour, and it's very, very difficult to make up 200 kilometers at those speeds, isn't it? I mean, if you look at, I think
200 kilometers or 200 meters.
Sorry, 200 meters.
here we go again.
You know, I struggle with that. But if we look at, you know, maybe we'll talk about this in more detail later, but if we look at Caleb Ewan, and his ride was rightfully praised, but I would suggest that his ascent of the Poggio was more a triumph of positioning than it was of legs. He was in the same position at the top of the Poggio that he was at the bottom, and that was it's simply because if you're riding at 35 kilometers an hour, you know, and you're in someone's slipstream, it's relatively easy, regardless of gradient. You know, if we're talking about a climb that's never really goes above 5 or 6%.
To take your casino analogy, I mean, Jasper Stuyven, I mean, he walked around every table and every machine with his hands in his pockets, and then he wheeled everything out on and put it all on red 15 just as they were coming off the bottom of the Poggio. I mean, it was in the sweet spot, wasn't it? Not quite as the descent had leveled out onto the flat road. Perfect timing to get away, but then it's all about the strength over that last 1.6, 1.8 kilometres to stay away. And even when Søren Kraut Andersen got up to him and, you know, they kind of, you know, rode together for a little bit, it did look, for all the world, like the group was going to come back to them. And then somehow he just found the legs, opened up the sprint again. And, I mean, the fact that he sat down and crossed the line, you know, in the saddle, you know, having it seemed like his legs had given up on him. It would be really interesting to know whether he thought he had it in the bag at that point or not. But I mean, a real impressive finale. And I suppose, Daniel, going back to what you were saying last week about it really is a winner takes all race, isn't it? You have to go all in on whatever your one move is. And once Julian Alaphilippe had made his one move on the climb, and it hadn't really brought a small enough group away, it was just too big a group, wasn't it, to make it into that sort of 3, 4, 5 man descent of the Poggio. And then there could have been a bit of tactical playing around on that run in. The group was big, and I think in a funny way, the bigger the group, the more the pendulum swings in the favour of somebody who does make an all or nothing move, because there's more people to look at each other. You know, who's going to chase that?
Yeah, and so much also depends then on who's in that group and whether one of these sprinters has a teammate. You know, if Caleb Ewan or the one the question actually, Peter Sagan did have a teammate there, Max Schachmann, but perhaps not confident enough that he could beat Wout van Aert, Caleb Ewan, sprinters like that in the final.
Again, though, Rich, in that position, you have to be willing to lose the race, and you have to just say, yeah, well, what's our best chance here? Our only chance, really, is Schachmann goes to the front, and we don't know how much Schachmann had left in the tank, but really, at that point, Schachmann needed to go straight to the front at the bottom of the Poggio and ride it as close as he possibly could to 50, 55k an hour and just at an even tempo. And then, you know, Sagan might still have got fourth place, but that was really their only hope at that point. And I don't know. I mean, it must be so difficult to coordinate things at that point, you know, that the race is moving too quickly for the directors in the cars in a lot of cases. And, you know, whether the message came from the Bora Hansgrohe car to Schachmann to get to the front and do exactly that, I don't know.
There was also a little group coming up with Pascal Ackermann in it. Ackermann. You know, there were some good sprinters coming up from behind Buhani, Demar, Ackermann. So Bora Hansgrohe might have been playing a bit of a sort of gambling at that point. You know, Ackermann might have been a better bet in a group sprint than Sagan, but I think Sagan probably surprised a lot of people by finishing fourth. Caleb Ewan, you're right to highlight his performance. I think a lot of riders who didn't win still rode extremely well. It reminded me of Caleb Ewan's interview with Adam Blythe for the Cycling Podcast a couple of years ago, I think it was, where I learned a lot about Caleb Ewan in that conversation and about what an all-rounder he was as a younger rider. And, you know, actually known as a bit of a climber in his under 23 days. So, you know, he rode almost a perfect race, or really a perfect race. Wout van Aert didn't do an awful lot wrong. You know, it's funny because three teams really committed to controlling or trying to control the race. Alpecin, Fenix, De Koenig, Quickstep and Jumbo-Visma. And then we saw, as you said, Jumbo-Visma on the Cipressa, Ineos Grenadiers on the Poggio. And it's one of these races where at the end of it, there's a lot of kind of analysis of which teams got it right, which teams got it wrong. Do we, by definition, say that every team got it wrong apart from Trek Segafredo, who put somebody in the no-hopers break, you know? Nicola Conchi was there. it's not really, you can't really say that even Ineos Grenadiers got it wrong. I mean, what do you think caused the group to be so big at the top? Because as you say, Daniel, every year Alaphilippe or Van Aert goes at the same point. Why were they not able to get a gap at that point? And why do you think the group was so big going over the top of the Poggio this year?
Well, I would make almost the opposite point, Rich. And one thing that I was curious to hear your views on was, how is it that Milan-San Remo is getting more and more selective, as I see it? I think as the years have gone by, if you compare the Milan-San Remos of recent years to the ones we saw at the end of the 90s and early 2000s, then you can easily talk about doping. And who knows, that might be a factor. But it does strike me that, particularly with a race as fast as it was at the weekend, 45 kilometres an hour, whether this is one race where we see the influence of aerodynamics to a large degree, and whether that's something that kind of cleaves open just, you know, very slowly as the kilometers tick by, it just creates these gaps that we didn't used to see. I mean, it was a big group there were a number of riders in that group that went over the Poggio first, but no one, as we said, apart from Sagan, who had a teammate. There were two Bahrain riders, but I think either Mohoric or Colbrelli made contact pretty late. I know the teams are one man smaller than they were a few years ago. It's now seven man teams instead of eight man teams. But it does sort of intrigue me that this race continues to be so selective. I mean, do you sort of see what I mean by that? Particularly, you know, if I think back to the San Remo's, the Eric Zabel one in the late 90s and the early noughties, there we did see lead out trains, or we at least saw, you know, two or three teammates to kind of pilot a sprinter into Via Roma, and we haven't seen that for years now.
I think one other aspect that was interesting, after, you know, no attacks on the Cipressa, which was, we normally see something, don't we, on the Cipressa, between the Cipressa and the Poggio, the bunch split into two groups temporarily, didn't it? Not for very long, and, you know, nothing really was doing at the front, but you know, by the time they got into the Poggio, the pace was on. You know, Ineos did a very strong job getting him into the bottom of the Poggio and setting the pace at the bottom. I think everyone kind of knows what's going to happen, and the recent years have suggested that a group that goes away over the top with some sort of gap has got a chance of holding that gap on the descent and into the Via Roma. And everyone was kind of alert to the splits happening. Just to go back, Richard, to your point about Caleb Ewan, I thought that was ride of the day, really, because, you know, he is a sprinter, but he got up there onto sort of second or third wheel. And there was one little moment with around 6 kilometres to go on the Poggio. It almost looked like he was launching an attack of his own, which... You know, I was thinking at the time, you don't need to do that here. Just get down the other side.
Was that too much of a flex? In the sense, it did strike me across my mind that maybe that sort of moment of hesitation, that moment of all looking at each other at the bottom of the Poggio when Stuyven went away, that was possibly caused by the knowledge of Ewan being so strong. I'm not sure that would have happened.
It was telegraphing it, wasn't it?
Well,
it
really why not attack? Okay, that might have, as you said, you've got to gamble on losing in order to win. Mm. Even if you're a sprinter, even if you're one of the quickest sprinters in the world, a group sprint is still a gamble. There is no guarantee with that at all. And there were other fast sprinters there. So say, you know, everybody was waiting for the Alaphilippe attack, and Van Aert, as he did last year, followed him, and it was nullified. And there was a moment there where somebody could have gone, why not Caleb Ewan solo to the victory? Why not though? Why not? Because there wouldn't have been, it would not have provoked the same reaction from behind as an Alaphilippe, Van Aert or Van der Poel attack.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by HelloFresh. And it sounds, Richard, are you in the kitchen already?
I am, Lionel. I am. I'm just tackling my HelloFresh. Just signed up to it again. First time I've had a box delivered in France. Got three recipes this morning.
Wow. HelloFresh is available in France as well as the UK.
Mm.
How does it differ to the UK version?
Well, all the menus are in French. Surprise, surprise. But I'm doing conchiglie au pesto rosso et alla feta, an Italian dish tonight.
Oh, how appropriate. How appropriate. Mm. Well, Rich, as you know, I fractured my collarbone a few weeks ago.
Not really mentioned it.
But one of the things, it's ruled me out of the kitchen for a few weeks. And I really underestimated how much I would miss it. Because since we've signed up to receive HelloFresh boxes, and we've been using them on and off for a couple of years now, it's really given me a sense of purpose in the kitchen. No more faffing around trying to think of what to cook and what to make that everyone will enjoy. And getting everything delivered in the box, already portioned out, all you have to do is the chopping. But obviously my chopping hand has been out of action because of my collarbone. So I'm good to go again now, and looking forward to making a sweet potato coconut dal this evening. That's what's on the menu here.
Nice.
The one thing I thought about with HelloFresh is, you know, when you watch cookery shows on TV and it all looks so simple because everything is already portioned out in dishes in front of the chef and they just sort of effortlessly chuck it together, that's very much the same experience, because all you have to do is open the box, take out the bag that has that night's meal in, follow the steps on the recipe card, and it's just the chopping and the stirring and the cooking, because all of the ingredients are already portioned out for you. So there's less food waste and there's less packaging waste as well. I don't know what the box is like over there in France, but here in the UK, it's you know, they really try to have the minimum amount of plastic packaging as possible, I think. So every week, there's around 35 recipes to choose from. We go for the full 5 days a week and get a menu and a meal box that contains enough for a full week. And so if you out there would like to try HelloFresh, you can get 50% off your first box and 35% off the next three with the code CYCLING. That's 50% off the first box and 35% off the next three with the code CYCLING at hellofresh.co.uk.
Well, we left it there with me imagining Caleb Ewan attacking on his own up the Poggio, descending on his own, and then winning alone. Why is that so fanciful?
With left field tactics that worked in the 1995 tour of the Trossachs, but never been tried or tested.
Well,
in
listen, he is a sprinter, but as I said earlier, he's actually, or was originally, a lot more than a sprinter. And other sprinters in the past, Sean Kelly, Laurent Jalabert, Johan Mazzeo, have gone from being bunch sprinters, more or less pure bunch sprinters, to different types of riders a bit later in their career. Caleb Ewan, maybe not at that point yet, but who's to say he wouldn't be capable of that? Who would have chased him down?
Well, everyone would have tried to chase him down, wouldn't they? That's the problem. Everyone chases everyone down the Poggio.
Okay, so Stuven then bridges across to him at the foot of the Poggio and Ewan outsprints him.
Caleb's son, you've been doing it wrong all these years.
Okay, moving on from that.
Getting to the finish in these big groups of riders, you should have just ridden off the front.
Richard Moore,
I don't normally
DS.
Go for these fanciful fanciful scenarios, but what are your other... Peter Sagan, very notable performance from him. He's had a very slow start to the year from him. Normally so consistent, but lost a chunk of training and some early races because he contracted COVID on a training camp in Gran Canaria. Fourth on the day was a very encouraging result from him. He's off to Catalonia to ride there instead of some of the other Belgian classics, but clearly on the road back. What other performances caught your eye, chaps?
If I can raise a slight bugbear of mine in this early season, The complaint, the grievance that because Team Ineos at certain points in certain races have multiple riders near the front of a peloton, they're somehow betraying going back on their vow to race aggressively this year. Racing aggressively, almost by its very nature, will involve putting multiple riders on the front of pelotons in different races this year, whether it's Tour de France, whether it's in one day races. You know, you can still racing in an exciting fashion by doing that. I don't think that when Dave Brailsford and others talked about this at the start of the season. They were going to race slightly differently. They didn't mean that they were going to be sending sort of, you know, Tom Pidcock or Michal Kwiatkowski on 200 kilometer sort of solo raids in Milan-San Remo. I mean, they took the race by the scruff of its neck after the Cipressa, really, didn't it? Well, and on the Cipressa to a certain extent. Just on the wisdom or not of Filippo Ganna working at the bottom of the Poggio. I mean, I think, Lionel, you can add something on this. But Ganna hadn't been feeling good early in the day, and he was dropped on the Cipressa. He certainly wasn't near the front of the bunch that came over the Cipressa. He ended up in the second group between the Cipressa and the Poggio. So it kind of understandable. And then they didn't know how the race was going to pan out on the top of the Poggio. Maybe they regretted making it work so early, but I think it was it's hard to reproach them for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, Daniel, you'd flagged up last week in our episode that Filippo Ganna could do a Jasper Stuyven and attack coming off the bottom of the Poggio, you know, maybe even late, waiting a bit later than Stuyven went and going on the flat, you know, doing a sort of Cancellara type move with his time trialing ability. And so it was a surprise watching. I mean, not that I take what you say as, you know, some kind of tactical genius, you know, you're not Richard Moore DS, are you, Daniel? but it looked like a real logical idea to me, that once you'd mentioned it. So it was a surprise to see Ganna going into the bottom of the Poggio, you know, really strong. Obviously, that effort would completely rule him out of being in contention at the top or being able to be in the front group at the finish, you would have thought. And so I asked Rod Ellingworth, Ineos director of racing, you know, what the tactic had been. And he told me that Ganna had been a little bit ill between Tirreno Adriatico and Milan San Remo, which in hindsight perhaps suggests why he was slightly below and didn't win the time trial on the final day of Tirreno Adriatico. And then in the first couple of hours of the race, said he didn't feel very good. And although he came round, he made it clear when they kind of had their, you know, right, what's going to be our strategy in the end game. Ganna made it clear that it wasn't a day for him because he didn't think he could pull off a win. So he basically did an earlier job. And it was really then all about Tom Pidcock, wasn't it? I mean, Kwiatkowski was kind of lurking in there as well, but Pidcock was really eye-catching on the Poggio. You know, he was lively, he was getting on wheels quickly. He was making, if not the first split, he would make the second split. And then when they went down the Poggio, he was one of the ones that was really pushing it on. And perhaps, as Rod said to me, you know, maybe got a little bit overexcited at the wrong moment and should have waited to put everything on one particular effort. But he's a first-year professional. It's a 300-kilometre-long race. You know, his time will surely come. And I think you saw as he crossed the line, Julian Alaphilippe gave him a pat on the back, didn't he? You know, it was a good ride from someone who is still, let's not, you know, he's still learning about these races. I mean, he will not have raced the descent of the Poggio before or the climb of the Poggio. You know, it's all brand new for him. And I suppose that's another point Daniel's made about the, you know, the sort of going into Milan-San Remo as a new rider and seeing it all for the first time and just racing really instinctively, the danger perhaps is over complicating and you know creating problems where there aren't any in subsequent editions, but we shall see. So I thought they had a plan and they tried to execute it, and perhaps their result didn't really reflect the impact that they'd had on the race.
Just on that point, Lionel, of knowing, not knowing the course, knowing the Poggio, and five of the top 10 live in Monaco. And Caleb Ewan made that point in his interviews after the finish, that he'd practiced the Poggio numerous times, and you know he'd sort of played that exact race scenario, or he'd simulated it on numerous occasions.
Well, next time, Caleb, if you're listening, have a little practice attack going up the Poggio. But how far is it from Monaco to San Remo? About an hour's ride or something?
Not even, I don't think.
I mean, they can definitely do it in a day. It's not that.
Yeah, no, I realise it's pretty pretty close. I got the train last year from Nice to through San Remo, and it's pretty close.
Struck me, chaps, that this year I think we may well see the first complete top 10 of a monument or a grand tour made up entirely of Andorra and Monaco residents. The Tour de France last year, of course, the whole podium lived in Monaco. The Vuelta last year, there was a very high percentage of Andorra residents. So.
Very quirky. That's a very quirky fact, that, Daniel. I'll leave you to look out for that.
Causation or correlation? What's the... I mean, just on one other thing that people often talk about in the run-up to Milan-San Remo, which of the two stage races is the best preparation, Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico? Jasper Stuyven, of course, rode Paris-Nice. And then the next four all rode Tirreno-Adriatico. Caleb Ewan didn't start stage four, but the others all completed Tirreno-Adriatico. So of the top 17 who made that split, eight rode Tirreno, six rode Paris-Nice, and three did neither. Sonny Colbrelli did the last race he did was the Trofeo Leguaglia in Italy. Mohoric didn't do either, and Tom Pidcock didn't do either. He last raced at Strade Bianche. So I guess, Paris-Nice won it this year.
And Nicola Conchi didn't just spend the whole day at Milan-San Remo in the break, but he also raced the next day as well.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, use the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And if you have a question for James Morton at Science and Sport, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you can send it as an audio file, all the better. We'll put your sports nutritional questions to James very soon. Let's do slow radio, shall we? Sorry to slow things down a bit, but this is a submission from Jono Mitchell, who says, I have to admit, I was a little sceptical of slow radio initially, but recently I noticed that I'm now more aware of the sounds on my local rides. Particularly, I noticed the birds here in Australia are much more noticeable than in other slow radio submissions. So now, a slow radio convert, here is my submission. Well, some lovely bird sounds there. Thanks for that, John O'Mitchell. And if you have a submission for slow radio, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
That on a loop would have been the perfect accompaniment for about the first 6 hours, 20 minutes of Milan-San Remo on Saturday, wouldn't it?
Well, what a great idea,
restful,
Lionel.
Restful.
Does it have to be cycling related?
What, the slow radio?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the idea. The idea is to bring people's cycling sounds into the podcast and transport listeners away, but also to make more of a feature of the sounds of cycling, because I think they are sometimes, we don't really hear what the sport sounds like a lot of the time, so it's nice to hear it.
So if I just record birds, it probably won't get on.
That's, well, I mean, Daniel, this is your default question in any editorial planning meeting, isn't it? For the podcast, does it have to be cycling related?
So listen, still talking about Milan San Remo, have we talked enough about Jasper Stuyven? I mean, one thing I thought watching him win the race, and I watched the finale again, you know, just to try and spot where he was throughout, and he was a very understated performance, you know, until that moment where he went. But I did think back to last year and the incredible form he was in on opening weekend. I was there. He won Het Nieuwsblad, but he seemed to be absolutely pinging. And You know, there's some kind of justice, I think, in him winning Milan-San Remo this year, because he's been on the cusp of a monument, I guess, for a few years. We've spoken a bit this year about how he's also become a lead-out man for Mads Pedersen. They work well together, but an awful lot of the time so far this season, it has seemed that he's been the bridesmaid to Pedersen, Mads Pedersen, that is. And we wondered how he felt about that and when and if he would get his chance. Well, he really took it extremely well here, and it seemed to be a very popular win with other riders as well, who obviously recognise him as one of the strongest riders in the sport at the moment.
Yeah, you say that, Rich. I mean, remember 2016 when he won Koerner, Brussels Koerner with that solo break on the finishing circuit. Real, real strong ride to hold off basically everyone else who wanted to bring it down to a sprint. And then the following year, he's fourth in Paris-Roubaix, having made it into the final five who had the sprint on the velodrome in Roubaix. That was when Greg Van Avermaet won the race. And you say knocking on the door for a monument. I mean, it really, last year's win, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, suggested that perhaps he was ready to make a move in the rest of the classics over the spring. But of course, COVID denied him that opportunity. But Milan-San Remo is another level to even Het Nieuwsblad, isn't it? And it just makes you wonder whether he can go on and add another one, perhaps this spring, Tour of Flanders or a Paris-Roubaix, because he clearly, well, he's got what's required. You know, race on the
cobbles,
the hills, yeah, strong team.
We had an interview with their general manager Luca Guercellena during our Giro last year, didn't we? And we got a real sense from that of who he is and what type of squad he's wanted to build. But I think we've maybe felt they've got Vincenzo Nibali and Richie Porte. They've invested quite a lot in older riders. That paid off with Porte last year. And we've kind of wondered what their defining characteristic was and what their USP was, I suppose. But they've had an amazing start to the year, an amazing start to last year as well, actually, and an amazing weekend.
Yeah, they did have a great weekend, Rich. And just thinking about Stuyven, I think at the moment he's in that perfect sweet spot, if you like, where he's, you know, he's a very fast rider. He's won or come very close to winning bunch sprints in quite exalted company. But he's not so fast that people are necessarily terrified of him and won't take him to the finish line. And particularly when he's competing against riders like Van Aert and Van der Poel. And, you know, Sagan, he's someone who can still slip under the radar. I mean, that obviously won't continue to be the case if he does go on to win more monuments this spring. But I've been impressed as well with how selfless he's at least appeared to be. I mean, we're not necessarily party to the conversations going on in the team, and just witnessing, observing the dynamic between him and Mads Pedersen. He's at times seemed to be in Pedersen's shadow, particularly last year at the Tour de France. And it didn't, you know, there was no sense of any kind of grumbling or any ego preventing him from doing his job. And as you say, it did seem to be a very popular win at the weekend.
You mentioned Van Aert and Van der Poel there. And just one other thing that you've said in recent weeks, and you said before about Peter Sagan and Milan-San Remo, he'll win it, I think, maybe Richard's point, but he'll win it when no one's really expecting him to win it. And that was almost the case this weekend, wasn't it? I mean, he was there, he was very, very close, fourth place again for him, but didn't really, do much, didn't sort of flex his muscles on the Poggio particularly, just followed and waited. But the problem for Van Aert and Van der Poel was all of the eyes must have been on them. I mean, my eyes were certainly on them. And Van der Poel in his Dutch champions kit as well is, I mean, you can't miss him whenever he's making a move. And so, although we did notice him slipping out of position, it was doubly obvious because of the kit he's in. But neither of them really took the race on or made a move, certainly nothing as demonstrative as Julian Alaphilippe, who did at least try to make the attack on the Poggio. The other two really looked like they were, well, Van der Poel perhaps hoping that it would come down to a sprint where he'd have the opportunity. And maybe that was what Van Aert was thinking as well, because neither of them actually, you know, tried to take the race into their own hands, which I think surprised me. Or perhaps it was so obvious that they were going to attack on the Poggio that it became impossible for them.
And yet, Van Aert, you have to acknowledge that Van Aert was centimetres from another masterpiece and from us all hailing him again, because, you know, that's all it was. You know, it's one turn less by, or it's Søren Kragh Andersen arriving on or making up to Stuyven, you know, 2 seconds later or 2 seconds earlier, and you know, that changes the whole result. I mean, again, I sort of used that Tetris analogy, but it's those last 2 or 3 kilometers as well, they're kind of like being, I imagine they're being like attacked by a swarm of wasps. Every move you make in one direction to kind of swat something away is going to, there'll be consequences in another direction. You, nothing you can do is without jeopardy in some respects, and it's you do need a lot of luck, as well as good timing, good judgment, good instinct, and strong legs to win that race.
And would Stuyven have won it had Søren Kragh Andersen not bridged up to him? Because
Definitely not.
That, you know, Kragh Andersen sort of maybe slightly naive, but then you could also say that he was gambling to try and win it. That he, when he caught up with Jasper Stuyven, maybe assumed that Stuyven was flagging a bit and rode really hard and gave Stuyven a bit of impetus when he needed it. But Stuyven probably always going to win that sprint, although Kragh Andersen's a very good sprinter as well. But I think Kragh Andersen, we could see in the way that he faded in the finish, how much he'd spent getting across to Stuyven and then kind of pulling him towards the finish. So yeah, all these things came into play. Well, we should wrap things up there, fellas. I agree with your, I think it was your point, Daniel, about Van Aert being, you know, fractions of centimeters away from another masterpiece. And, you know, if you look at his performances over the season so far, Tirreno Adriatico and then Milan-San Remo just a few days later, after going very deep in that race to hold on to second overall, winning a couple of stages there, it's pretty impressive. And from a team point of view, they rode a very good race. It seemed to me that he was gambling on the Poggio on either Van der Poel or Alaphilippe or both attacking really hard and going with them and winning it in the same way that he won it last year. But no, another very good performance. And it was one of these races where we can look at I know that Ewan was very disappointed to finish second, but you can look at a lot of performances there and say that they all rode very good races. Only one winner, of course.
One guy, chaps, we haven't mentioned, and we should just before we close, is Golden Greg. We didn't so much write him off as express, or I expressed concerns that, you know, with the Galacticos bowling into town, that he was starting to look a little bit, or he might start to look a little bit like yesterday's man. He was very much in the thick of things. But one thing that caught my eye was something he said after the finish, I think, on Saturday. He said, Milan-San Remo is not a fair race, which I can see what he means. That, you know, it does have this element of a lottery about it. You know, what we just said about Van Aert really bears that out. Or you can take the alternative view and say that, you know, it needs to be evaluated in a different way. You're not looking at centimetres and metres, you're looking at millimetres and centimetres. And that, you know, if we are talking about 50 centimetres between second and fifth, that's 50 centimetres that you've somehow frittered over the course of the previous 300 kilometres, a bit like, you know, what I was saying about Van der Poel, those tiny little micro efforts. Maybe you do necessarily pay for those, and luck has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, Golden Greg, of course, is Greg Van Avermaet you're referring to there.
Sorry.
And I can sort of interpret what he's saying there, because not all riders are equal, are they? Because Wout Van Aert or Matthew Van der Poel or Julian Alaphilippe would not have been able to make the same move as Jasper Stuyven, because they wouldn't have been able to kind of drift into the position to make the move in the first place, because one or other of the others would have been on the wheel. And so they're not all playing with the same set of cards, to go back to the casino analogy. And so I can see what you're saying. And even though he is in the sort of autumn of his career, Van Avermaet is not a rider that you let have a lot of leeway. His reputation goes before him. And so he might feel that, yeah.
We're getting to a point where you could almost say his reputation goes behind him, but maybe that's unkind.
but he would have been marked, you know, he would have been marked perhaps a bit closer than Stuyven or even Kraut Andersen. I mean,
maybe, and certainly more closely than Caleb Ewan on the Poggio, for example. I said on Twitter that Stuyven was both a surprise winner and not a surprise at all. And that kind of sums up Milan-San Remo for me. And even just watching the way he rode the race in the final hour, you can't really look at it and go, well, I can see why he won because he did that then. You know, he made one absolutely decisive, lethal action and it won him the race. And then he was very cool and calculating when Kraut Andersen got across to him. So it was a brilliantly taken win, but it was opportunistic. And that is sometimes how Milan-San Remo is won. And it's not to take anything away at all from the win. We should wrap things up, though, fellas. And who are your 18 to watch at E3, Daniel?
Maybe I'll publish them on the Cycling Podcast Twitter account.
I think you reserve that for Monuments generally.
Monuments and Grand
Tours,
really.
Yeah, okay. 18 to watch at the Dwars Door of Landeren.
18
Excellent.
Top Monaco and Andorra residents to watch.
Anyway, we'll be back next week. I should mention second episode of El Cycling Podcast, the cycling podcast in Spanish with Rob Hatch and Laura Messiger went out last week. If you understand Spanish, give it a listen. It's on a separate feed. Just search for El Cycling Podcast, add it to your podcast app. They've got an interview with Superman, Miguel Angel Lopez, in the latest episode. I wasn't really aware of how much trouble he's been in after his crash on stage one at the Giro. And he was very unhappy at having to ride the Giro, having ridden the Tour. Called it inhuman. He's moved to Movistar now, but he has said he hasn't touched his bike in 5 months, which I find remarkable. And he's had COVID as well. So,
earlier on, he's on a one-year contract.
You mentioned this earlier before we started recording that he's on a one-year contract. So not a great start to his Movistar career. But check out El Cycling Podcast if you speak Spanish. As Lionel said, we've got the Lionel Flanders coming up for Friends of the Podcast.
Also a little plug for Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton, the most recent episode with Robbie McEwen, who'll be very familiar to Australians. Well, very familiar to everyone because he's won 12 stages of the Tour de France. But if you watch the Tour de France coverage in Australia or you're in a country that gets the world feed, you'll hear Robbie McEwen as the co-commentator alongside Matt Keenan. And I found it a really interesting podcast, Robbie McEwen talking about racing, sprinting, lead out trains, tactics, etiquette. So check that out. That's on our feed now. Life in the Peloton, hosted by EF Education Nippo rider Mitch Docker.
And coming out later this week, Service Course with Tom Wally and Ian Boswell standing in for Lizzie Banks this month, who is unfortunately unavailable this month. She'll be back next month, but Ian Boswell is filling her shoes in Service Course coming later this week. So listen out for that. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.